Thank you, Ralph. I'll be interested in hearing what I have to say, too, about the future of seminary education. I'm sure that there will be a lot of discussion on the various things that will come up, and I suppose that I might find myself in one particular place being run over by everybody else. I don't know if you've run across this one yet, the Bosselman's rule that says if everything seems to be coming your way, you're probably in the wrong lane, and that's probably where I may be at the end of all of this. But at least I'd like to just go into the area a bit, and I hope you will understand that when I am speaking this afternoon, I am going to want to be learning as much from you as I might be giving you in any way, because I have just begun this work. I'm starting to become more understanding of what is happening in all of the different schools. I visited quite a number of them since I have joined the staff down at the Board for Higher Education, but I still have a number of places to go, and I have not been on this campus to really look at its curriculum or anything of that sort. So when I speak this afternoon, you may have many questions that you will want to deal with, and I'm sure that one of the questions will probably be relating to subsidy, and I'll try to talk about that if you want to discuss it, and I'll do the best I can. But when I was given this particular topic to speak about the future of seminary education in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, I, of course, recognized immediately that it's a very broad topic, and in fact, it is so broad that it's very difficult to know the direction which to take in a discussion of the issues. And yet, I think that it is something with which we have to deal, and something which I know consumes a great deal of time and individual thought on the part of all of you, and on the part of your committees, and in part of the total faculty in its discussions. It's an important topic because unless we know our goal, identify it clearly, and constantly keep it before us, we'll never know whether it has been achieved. And it must be established if we are ever to be able to evaluate the work which we do from day to day. We might never reach that goal. Nevertheless, that goal is a compass which guides us as we seek to carry out our tasks. A compass doesn't do away with traveling, it only points the direction. And knowing the way one has to go is a very important place to begin. Perhaps it should also be said that if we ever expect to see the final results of our work, we have maybe not asked a big enough question. So when we speak of the goal and the future of seminary education in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, what is the question we are addressing? Is it the question of the number of seminaries which should exist to provide the manpower needs for the tasks before us? Now that's a question that is being asked, and it's being asked in many places. It is being asked, for example, in Canada, where I will be going tomorrow to discuss with them the future of seminary education in Canada, as they are trying to determine just what they will do. You remember that the Synod last year passed a resolution for establishing St. Catharines immediately, and St. Catharines at this point has asked to have permission to lease some property on the campus of Brock University, and they have made no plans for building yet at this point, but they have asked for that authorization. At the same time, another resolution was passed, you may recall, which said that the seminary education at Saskatoon was to be phased out by the end of the academic year 1981, and the Board for Higher Education was to make plans for the transition to a permanent kind of establishment for Western seminary education in Canada, for Western Canada. And that's a problem. We really don't know where we're going at this point. I'm sure that if you have some words of wisdom on that issue, I would be happy to hear them, and I'd be happy to share them with the people. So the question is, you know, should it be a single seminary, or should there be a seminary located in Western Canada, a place still to be determined, and then St. Catharines besides that? That's a very important question. I don't know what the action of the Board of Directors was at its last meeting. I can only say at this point that one of the recommendations which the Board for Higher Education made was that any decision on the seminary education in Western Canada be delayed until after the next convention, and that in the meantime, for those students who wish to attend a seminary in Canada, we would provide for those in need transportation to St. Catharines as a transitional kind of situation. I don't know what the action of the Board of Directors was, though, in relation to that suggestion. There are other areas, of course, too, where you have similar situations arising. Brazil and Argentina face that question. With the limited funds which are available, and I know, of course, they have different languages which they use there, but with the limited funds that are available, a situation that which you're all too familiar, is it wise to expend $50,000 to $75,000 or more annually in the preparation of a half dozen or less students in one of those seminaries? How about the United States? Are two seminaries enough? Is the location right? Should the programs of the seminaries be virtually identical, or in these days of rapid change, could there be a seminary for preparation and a seminary for continuing education? Should there be a seminary for missions, and should seminaries be specialized as they once were, with the emphasis on one which was termed practical and the other a classical approach? The question of specialization is an important one, involving not only efficiency but viability. At its recent convention, the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod adopted some planning principles presented by the Board for Higher Education. As a result of that action, we have begun to see an expansion program on almost all of the campuses owned and operated by the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. What was once a system of schools has, to a large extent, become an association of Lutheran colleges and seminaries. And the results of that expansion are going to require close monitoring and evaluation if quality programs are to be maintained. It's interesting to note that as this expansion occurs, there is frequently a virtual duplication of all programs on all campuses. The moment one school introduces a program which appears to be successful or has promise of success, another feels compelled to add that program to its offerings. And, of course, it will be done under a different name or a different title, to be sure, but it's nevertheless a duplication. And in a period of time when the student market is decreasing, those efforts are easily understood. But the question remains as to whether a competitive or a cooperative approach is the more desirable. And on the seminary level, I suppose that raises the question of whether there should be individual boards of control for seminaries, as we have, or whether it would be wiser to have one board of control for seminary education in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. And the same question arises in relation to colleges, in which the question of individual boards of control or a university concept with a single board of regents and with campuses of the university in various locations would be more effective. And I don't know whether anything like that would ever be possible. But as long as we have individual boards of control on each of the campuses of the seminaries, you cannot blame the boards of control for some of the actions which they take, because they are determined to make that school successful and sometimes do not see the total effect on the system or association, if you will. When we deal with the future of seminary education in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, perhaps the question should be asked in terms of support. At what level should the church feel an obligation to provide support for programs at the seminaries? At a 30% level, 50%, 75%, or 100%? And there are those who feel quite strongly that if the church is to maintain its responsibility for the education of its future pastors, it should provide the total cost of tuition or educational fees for all of those who are attending. Now, it's recognized, of course, that the cost of living is another matter, but the educational fees as such, perhaps should they be covered totally? However, when seminaries as well as colleges are required to seek funds for operation from the sources often unrelated to the church, a feeling of independence can easily develop and can easily be understood. Only the dedication of men and women such as you people who are there in our colleges and seminaries, and the commitment which they feel toward the church, I think, has enabled us to maintain the level of excellence in education and the uniformity which we presently have. But you know as well as I do that the world is ever with us, and we are all aware that the question constantly arises as to how much commitment can be expected. I don't know what the answers to some of those questions are. I do know that I feel very strongly that if we are going to maintain the kind of higher educational system which we have, there must be more funds which will be made available for that educational system or that association of schools. We cannot continue as we have done, I think, this year, with virtually the same amount of synodical subsidy being made available for all of the schools, with absolutely no change whatsoever, and the increased costs which develop at those schools. Something must be done. I don't know what it will be. Perhaps it might be a situation whereby we have special offerings twice a year, maybe once for missions and maybe once for education as a special offering. Maybe that would help us to generate some of those additional funds which are needed. Now, while all of these are factors which deserve consideration in the future of seminary education in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, and maybe those are the ones you will want to discuss later on, perhaps the future could best be addressed in terms of the type of curriculum which should be developed and promoted. And I make no claim to being an expert in this area at all. You people are the ones who are the experts. I, of course, have ideas, and so do you. And they're reflected in the changes which have occurred over the years, as well as in the materials which you prepare and in the teaching which occurs in your classrooms. It's very possible we may not agree, and that's good, I think, because if two agree on everything, as someone has said, you can be sure that only one is doing the thinking. And I have no doubt that many of my ideas are wrong. And I would only ask that we pray the prayer which I read somewhere, which says, Lord, when we are wrong, make us willing to change, and when we are right, make us easy to live with. Well, when we discuss the future of seminary education in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod from this point of view, it seems best to approach it, I think, from the traditional standpoint of knowledge, attitudes, and skills. And from another viewpoint, I would like to label those in terms of preparation as prophet, servant, and priest. And it should be clear from the very outset that these are not mutually exclusive. Just as you cannot separate the area of skills from knowledge and attitudes, so you cannot separate the role of priest from that of prophet or servant. And for that reason, I'm not completely comfortable or happy with this kind of distinction because it's so easily misunderstood. Nevertheless, I think for the purposes of our discussion, I would like to use that kind of approach. And so I'd like to talk first about knowledge in terms of the role of the prophet. And when we deal with the area of knowledge as related to the preparation for the pastoral ministry or for any other service, the question in one's teaching is whether he is subject-oriented or people-oriented, assuming that there are those two poles. From a professional point of view, it is much more comfortable, I think, to be subject-oriented than people-oriented. Since I've not been a member of a seminary faculty, I can only reflect my experience as a member of a college faculty and as a president of one of our synodical institutions. And in that situation, it was easy to think of building a kingdom of science, history, social science, physical education, and so on. A course in world history was not enough, nor is it enough to go into ancient and modern history. All of those must be divided into ever smaller segments. And naturally, these courses must be added to the curriculum. A course in swimming is not enough. You must have Aquatics 1, Aquatics 2, Junior Life Saving, Senior Life Saving, and Water Safety instruction, plus safety and first aid. And that's only one facet of the physical education program. Obviously, you know, we could go on and on and on, and whether this is true or not on a seminary level, I'm not certain. However, I suspect that it may also be true in the traditional categories of the exegetical, systematic, historical, and practical theology. The justification for these positions is there, to be sure, and it's based on the fact that an ever-increasing body of knowledge must be mastered. And you know as well as I do that no one can no longer be an expert merely in Pauline theology. It isn't even enough to be a master of one of the Pauline epistles. There is so much knowledge that is available that it's difficult to be an authority even in one small section of his writings. And no one wants to disparage knowledge in any way. Nevertheless, perhaps it is our attitude towards it which is of most importance. It's like a certain view, I think, of confirmation instructions which might assume that the candidate for confirmation must receive instruction in everything he needs for the rest of his spiritual life. Confirmand is not really prepared unless he has this bit of information. And if one is only or primarily subject-oriented, the same attitude could develop with regard to preparation for the ministry. No one is really prepared for it unless he has this course, mine, and possesses this information which I have to dispense. A knowledge approach may not only be comfortable for the instructor, but also for the student. The capacity for absorbing such knowledge, which is characteristic of the typical seminary student, assuming that there is such a person, can satisfy a personal inclination and can provide personal satisfaction. Because as that knowledge grows, his ego may be satisfied and it may provide him with a sense of security in the knowledge that he has knowledge which others do not possess. Now, obviously, that's not the purpose of the instructor as he prepares one for ministry. Nevertheless, if that is the major focus of the instruction, it could easily be the result. Now, as I said before, in no way do I wish to diminish the importance of knowledge and scholarly effort. Absolutely not. The question, however, in terms of the future of seminary education in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, is how much knowledge is necessary and how much can be provided during that period of preparation, and how much emphasis should be placed upon it without resulting in the development of an undesirable attitude. Academic preparation in the sense of knowledge is absolutely necessary, and the continuing question is how much, and that's a recurring concern as this body of knowledge increases. And consequently, as you also know very well, a curriculum cannot remain constant. Curriculum review is a perpetual task, and there's always a temptation to require too much knowledge, or if circumstances such as a pastoral shortage develop, requiring too little. And the latter could easily become a danger which could confront us. Now, a further problem which arises when instruction is almost exclusively subject-oriented is that of integration of the knowledge. As an instructor at Seward, for example, a constant but very proper question which was asked when new courses were presented for adoption was, how are theological insights reflected in the objectives of this course? Of course, that was asked by a few of us on the faculty. And it wasn't long before the parallel question was asked when courses in theology were proposed. You know, the opposite. How are the insights of science or sociology incorporated in your courses in theology? That was the parallel question. The second, I think, is more important, of course, for those involved in preparation for men for the pastoral ministry in the church. Furthermore, it seems to me the question must be asked as to how the potential pastor is aided in his integration of the insights from the branches of theology. A theology student at another school expressed it this way, not a Lutheran school. He expressed it this way. He said, Fra Angelica painted his Annunciation in a Renaissance setting, a first century event in the medieval surroundings in which his viewers could relate. What we are about to be about is making the Annunciation, the announcing of Jesus Christ, real to people in the 20th century. The churches expect the seminaries to inhale men from society and exhale good ministers. What some churches do not realize is that churning out good ministers is not good enough. Theological education, by its very nature, must not only look at the education of ministers for the present, but it must look beyond the present with the thought of how to keep the product the church sells, that is the gospel, meaningful for people tomorrow, next week, and in ages to come. Our contemporary humanity is much like the adversary in Star Trek, Viger. Viger is a monstrous machine. At some point, Viger has learned everything there is to know about everything except one thing, how to make sense of it all. And likewise, a student may have mastered all the bits of knowledge which are there to offer and yet not know how to make sense of it all and how to use it in his ministry. Somewhere there must be an effort made to help him synthesize this knowledge. And I want to emphasize once again, if you haven't caught it by now, that I am not trying to imply that this isn't going on. I'm simply saying, are we doing it? How can it be done? And how might it be done better? Well, I label this area of knowledge as the prophetic task of the ministry for which a student is being prepared. I do so with the assumption that the major role of a prophet is to be a speaker for God, proclaiming that knowledge which has been revealed to him in the context of the present and the future, and of course, revealed to him in the Word. Secondly, we turn to the attitudes. As we've indicated, the future of seminary education in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod requires the preparation of men with knowledge. Knowledge, however, without the proper attitude does not result in ministry. Too often the position of pastor is aspired to because of the authority which that position supposedly possesses. That authority can only be defined in the student's mind as one which provides control over people and sometimes over circumstances. Now, the authority is there, but if it is a misinterpreted authority, it is going to result in disillusionment and discouragement. In a recent article in Christianity Today entitled, "Dear Church, I Quit," and some of you may have read that article, the writer said, "It is no secret that one objective of those entering the pastoral ministry has been the pursuit of some sort of authority position in which one can enjoy control over a module of people. For many, ministry seems to be the best place in which to pursue such an unhealthy purpose. What is tragic is that it appears to be all too easy for a man or man with mixed and unsound motives to move through theological training, gain access to a pastoral position, and only then find in the crucible of congregational pressure that what appeared to be an earnest desire to serve God and his people was actually the pursuit of a form of self-fulfillment. Once into the ministry, the first crisis that most often causes ministers to entertain the thought of leaving centers on the discovery that most congregations do not want to change. Highly trained in seminary and theological systems, taught to think through the logical elements of issues and exposed to the latest programmatic schemes, the young minister is often confused when he discovers that people are rarely brought to new levels of spiritual performance through persuasion based on logic or reason. His youthful idealism forces change and faces the resulting congregational backlash. And one has hardly been trained to face the reality of tradition, which is not always bad, subsurface prejudice, and deeply ingrained habit and attitude patterns. The result is a feeling of total helplessness and leadership impotence, and if the pollster calls at the right moment, usually a Monday morning, he is more often than not liable to hear an admission that amounts to occasional or often when asked if ever leaving the ministry is on his agenda. The one who is commissioned to be a pastor has authority, but that authority is one which is given with his commission and which derives from the word of him who commissions him, the Lord Jesus Christ. The question is, how does one develop an attitude of authority rather than authoritarianism? Or how does one prepare another for service rather than to be servo? In commenting on the attitude of his followers, Jesus described it this way. He said, "Whoever will be greatest among you, let him be your servant." An authority is not exercised by lording it over people, but the authority of the pastor is that of the servant and the authority to be a servant. The problem is how to develop such an attitude of service with authority. It seems to me that development of such an attitude requires a focus on the personal life of both instructor and student. It involves a revealing of oneself and one's need and an openness to receive the service of a brother in Christ to meet those needs. There's a need for assisting each other in self-understanding and self-acceptance as the healing power of the gospel is applied to those needs. And unless that happens in the life of the potential pastor, the desirable attitude of service with authority will probably never be developed. And now to skills, which I labeled the priestly role. Knowledge and attitude without the acquisition of the necessary skills will, of course, also result in some very real problems. In fact, it is here, in what I term the priestly role, that the rubber hits the road. If proper application of knowledge, of the knowledge one has gained, is practiced with the proper attitude, ministry occurs. But apart from the practice, it is like one who is an expert in knowing proper techniques in fishing, knows all of the proper lures to use, and has a desire to fish, but has never gone to the river or lake to test the validity of his knowledge or the effectiveness of those lures. The needs for ministry are constantly changing, or perhaps we might say the needs are always there, but either the emphasis has shifted or has become more intense. And one of these needs is represented in the teaching role of the ministry in an inductive sense. In a less complicated age, it may seem to have been and often was the task of the minister to supply answers to all of the ethical questions which were raised. Today, that wrestling with decisions has become much more intense, and the task of the pastor may not be so much that of providing answers as assisting people in learning and in the methods of arriving at those decisions. How skilled is the potential pastor in helping to identify the problems, in analyzing those problems, and in providing those guidelines from the Word of God upon which a mature Christian decision is based? There have always been people who vary from the norm to whom we must minister. And that number is steadily growing, as you know, too, so that one often wonders what the norm is. The large number of singles, for example, requires ministry. Yet much of the preparation for ministry is based on the view that the family is the norm and ministry is to the family. Young people still form a large part of the society, and a few years ago they were the dominant group. Now the numbers are shifting, as you well know, and the ministry to the aged or aging involves an even larger portion of pastoral time. And is the potential pastor prepared to minister to both groups? Can he be prepared to minister to both? Obviously, we could continue to list the areas such as these almost without limit, and yet they all seem to point to the great variety in ministry and underline the question of the adaptability of the graduate who may have had experience in almost all of the areas, and yet he has difficulty suddenly dealing with all of the various situations for which he now feels the responsibility. Previously, even on a vicarage, for example, he is assigned certain tasks by another responsible person. And now he's the responsible person with the authority given to him, and he may be unable to cope with that. What's being done to help him move to that position? Is that a skill which must be learned? Or does the seminary support or the support of the church end with graduation and placement? Now, another area of ministry with which the potential pastor must be prepared to cope is that of conflict resolution. We referred to it earlier under attitude as one of those conditions which are the cause of problems for the beginning pastor, or for that matter, any pastor. As he confronts conflict, there are a number of approaches which can be taken. One would be to defy the opposition and appeal to authority, or to deny that conflict exists. One can capitulate to the opposition, even though he is convinced that that opposition is wrong. Nevertheless, for the sake of peace, one will at least externally give up his position. Or one can try to win the opposition by the use of logic, clearly defending his position, only to find that opposition is not won over most often by logical thinking. Or one can recognize conflict, learn from it, and minister with and through it. And I suppose we would all agree that that last approach is probably best. Are potential pastors prepared? How well are they prepared to deal with conflict in this way? During the years of seminary preparation, the student receives assistance from a support system in which he is encouraged to develop close associations with fellow students, faculty, and others in the seminary community. They've been his support in maintaining his spiritual life at a very high level, helping him to deal with discouragement, pessimism, failure, and a host of other situations. Through regular worship opportunities, that spiritual life is supported and nourished. And now, how is the student prepared to function when that support system is removed and when he is expected to minister to others who view him as one who really doesn't need ministry? I guess I could give you some good examples in the personal life of mine. I am very grateful to a neighboring pastor who certainly gave me support, and because he understood that problem. I can remember particularly when my son died, that he came over and spoke to me about this whole matter, and he was very conscious of the fact that who ministers to the minister. And I needed it.
and needed it very much at that point. But if that doesn't happen and the person is placed in isolation, who ministers to the minister? How long are we going to have a concert? Yeah. Well, that's harmony more than harmony. Okay. Well, the question is, how is the person prepared to adjust from a situation in which he is encouraged to develop personal associations which support him to a congregational situation in which the development of those personal relationships and very close relationships is seen as a hindrance to his ministry? You can't get too close to anybody. What skills has he learned which will enable him to maintain a vibrant, faith-filled, enthusiastic ministry? And can those skills be taught? During his period of preparation at the seminary and even during his vicarage, the student is to a large extent directed in the use of his time. He is assigned specific tasks to be completed within a definite period of time. He has learned some skills in administration. He has learned pastoral skills. But how does he serve as parish administrator and pastor at the same time? And how has he been prepared for the skill of managing his time according to definite priorities? Can he be prepared for that? And can he be prepared to live with those priorities when he has determined them, even though he sees 100,000 other things to be done? While in the seminary, the student often has an idealized view of the parish. When he is placed in his first position with total responsibility and comes face to face with the full reality of the ministry, the shock and personal confrontation can be devastating. How do we prepare students so that shock will be cushioned, and with what self-care and survival skills do we equip the potential pastor? So to summarize, knowledge and attitude are extremely important as the pastor carries out his role as prophet and servant. But he cannot carry them out or as effectively as he might unless he's provided with the skills to implement those roles. And at this point, again, I want to make it very clear that no criticism of any kind is intended. In fact, the effectiveness of our seminaries bears witness to the excellent preparation they have received in their past or present seminary preparation. The question always is, can it be improved and how can it be improved? I guess from my own point of view, I think people are much better prepared today, perhaps, than I was when I left the seminary. I am very much appreciative of all the things which were done here for my son-in-law, who is now serving in the pastoral ministry. And I think he's much better prepared than I was when I left here. So I am not saying that a job is not being done. I hope you clearly understand that. Now, what I've raised all these questions. What about a possibility? And I know that this sometimes strikes a bad note, but I'd like to use the term competence-based education. If we ask what direction future seminary education should take, perhaps consideration should be given to that if it is not already being practiced. One definition of this, and I'd like to read the definition of it, of this approach is as follows. Competence-based education tends to be a form of education that derives a curriculum from an analysis of a prospective or actual role in modern society, and that attempts to certify student progress on the basis of demonstrated performance in some or all aspects of that role. Theoretically, such demonstrations of competence are independent of time served in formal educational settings. So the first step, then, would be an analysis of the professional role to be filled. We could very well conclude that this is what we have always been doing. Perhaps so. However, if we have not done so, we might, to a larger extent, include the professionals from the field, the practicing pastors, in breaking the role of the pastor into a large number of individual tasks and behaviors, into very minute portions of that. And in this way, the seminary program would be very closely linked to the actual world of practice. This effort to tie the learning of professional skills to their practice would help to bridge the gap that is sometimes believed to exist between those who are professionals preparing others and the practitioners in the real world into which the potential pastor will graduate. And you all know what I'm saying there in terms of how others look upon sometimes disparagingly a seminary as an ivory tower situation, which I don't believe it is, but they sometimes use those terms. Maybe that gap could be bridged. Those in the field see themselves as being in touch with practice as it really is. The professionals are in the forefront in terms of innovation, as they should be. And yet somehow the graduate has to be prepared to bridge that gap between the academic world, where he sees these new misunderstandings, insights, and methods of ministry which are proposed, and the congregation in which he will practice his ministry, where the innovations aren't known and they aren't understood, nor are they appreciated. Another feature of this approach to professional preparation is that students are graduated only after they have demonstrated competency in their professional role. And if that role is broken up into many parts, then the student could be certified as competent in one area before going on to another. And if that approach is taken, the expected outcome, though, must be stated very, very clearly and explicitly. What must that outcome be? Such an approach does not eliminate the need for instruction, for professionals in any way. Faculty guidance always continues to be necessary. And finally, such an approach also involves the element of flexible time. Not all students will proceed at the same pace, and therefore the time of preparation for the individual student may be lengthened or shortened, depending on demonstration of competency. There is no lockstep approach to the preparation, and I think you have it going on in terms of such things as colloquy programs. Now, such an approach might be far too ideal, maybe entirely unrealistic. It certainly adds to the faculty burdens when some students are moving more slowly or quickly than others, because it means that some will require special attention, and it may take them a much longer period of time. And in the present situation in which we are, that may not be possible. But certainly it is something for which I think we might, at which we might take a look. Just in closing on this, before I throw it open for discussion and find myself in the wrong lane as I started out, I would refer you to some things which I saw appearing in the paper of the other seminary, Fort Wayne. When Dr. Aho was asked a question about the pastor and what is involved in, and I think all this would apply to all of our seminaries, to both of our seminaries, what do you think people are looking for in the pastors that we produce at this seminary? Said, I think people want pastors who aren't looking just to their own advantage, but are willing to serve. They're looking for pastors who preach effective sermons, sermons that deal with their life situation, applying the strictures of law where they fit, but also the comfort of the gospel. They are looking for pastors who are competent to lead and to organize, so that the pastor and lay people together can do the work God has called them to do. Then the question was asked, have there been any changes in the preparation for the ministry that you've seen over the years? Yes, I think the seminary today is much more concerned than it was in my student days about the world in which we were living and about how pastors can function in this world, relating theology to the ethical and social problems that touch congregations and individual people. There is also a closer relationship between professors and students. When I went to the seminary, the professors were respected, but there were few with whom we talked freely. There's been a change also in the students. Students today are generally more critical, perceptive, and open than the students of 20, 30, or 40 years ago. They're not quite as ready as they were in my day to take the professor's word at face value. They raise questions and they want documentation. Do you think these changes have been for the better? I think so. A seminary graduate today is probably better equipped for ministry than the graduate of 30 or 40 years ago. He has a wider knowledge, and his practical training, at least at the seminary, is more extensive. Of course, no seminary can teach students everything they need to know. Learning must be lifelong. And finally, are more classes required now than in the past? I'm not sure. Different kinds of courses are required today, but increasing the number of courses doesn't necessarily improve a seminary's program. The classes in our department are conducted with actual functioning in the parish in view. For instance, the rationale of the fieldwork program is articulated more clearly, and the program is organized better than it was 30 years ago. Improvements can be made, but we have come a long way. And so I will stop at that point, and you may pick out any area which you wish to discuss. And if you don't have any areas to discuss, I have some questions that you might discuss if you would want to break up into about two or three groups. Or would you want to do that?
Either hand? What's your pleasure? You want to break up into groups and discuss questions, or would you prefer to first take a shot at a plenary discussion?
I'd prefer.
No, that's fine. Whichever.
What would you prefer, Walt? Would it make any difference to you?
No, it really doesn't make any difference to me.
Well, why don't we just open it up for general discussion, touching either on the points Walt has made or questions you would like to address to him or the BHE in general? We'll start with Dave then. Dave Daniel?
Your emphasis at the end on competency-based education is very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
It's the higher education corollary to back to basics in some respects at the elementary and secondary level.
Mm-hmm.
And it is being bandied about as an innovation.
Yeah.
Isn't this really an attempt to return to what was the European ideal of higher education, namely the preparation for specific professions, the preparation ending with a series of rigorous examinations, and that coursework was not required, any specific coursework was not required, rather the student took those courses which he felt was necessary to acquire that particular knowledge. So that if you're going to talk about competency-based education, the real necessary task is to develop what is competency. I think,
mm-hmm.
and have we really developed a clear, direct statement of what we as theologians, or what does the church at large, laymen and pastors alike, consider to be the necessary competencies of a pastor?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I fully agree with what you're saying. I am an advocate of the cyclical theory of education. I see that happening again and again. You know, you talk about the ungraded primary and ungraded classrooms. Well, those of us who attended a one-room, eighth-grade school know what that's like. And you were perhaps taking math with the fourth grade when you were in the third grade, or, you know, whatever your level happened to be. And so we've now come back to that kind of thing. We had modern math, and one of my children really got messed up in that. We had ITA reading programs, initial teaching alphabet reading programs, and I come back to phonetic approaches to the teaching of reading. And I think you're right. Your point is well made. That is what I was trying to get at in terms of the development of those competencies, just exactly what they are, and to state them and to break them up into very small areas, not just to simply state them in broad terms, is competent to do this, but make it very specific as to what that competency should be. And I agree with you, what you said, that it seems to me this is where pastors and congregations, all and lay people in the congregations, ought to be also involved in determining what they feel those competencies should be. And I think you'd have a bridging of that kind of gap in that point.
Anyone else with a comment? Dick?
Yeah, I'd like to resonate. I recall in my days, the last year that I was here, it cost me 300. develop a student, we've got a little shopping cart and who knocks down affirmatives and exegetics and then goes up. I don't know the answer to it. I'm sure that nobody does at this time. But we need to provide more freedom for our students to grow other than in the classroom. And the second thing I'd like to say, as far as competency is concerned, I know all about that. I'm in agreement with it, except that I tell my students nobody is competent when he leaves this place.
That's right.
The church itself, we provide the background upon which a man can become a pastor. Mm-hmm. And the church itself, and God bless those patient people out in our church who do, who realize when they take a new seminarian graduate that they too are the teacher. And maybe we need to tie this together more.
I have no quarrel with anything he said. I fully agree. I pointed, as I said, I wish we had the funds that I think are necessary in order to do this. And I pledge to you that I'll be fighting in every way I can to secure those funds and do all I can. Because as I concluded here, it does mean a heavier load, because if you're going to have people working individually with students and working at different levels and different paces, it means a heavier load, and that requires more people. But if we really want to do the best job we can, I think that's what we need.
Okay, John was next.
So I like your application of the traditional knowledge, attitudes and skills, and how you wove that in. I also like this idea of setting standards in terms of competency, because really that's what we're trying to do. It's not a matter of serving your time, of having completed a certain number of courses, but certainly of having acquired a given number of competencies. This would also suggest that the student might be permitted to proceed at his own pace, mm-hmm. in the sense that the student who doesn't have, let's say, the financial problems that Dr. Schultz alluded to, and he's going to be very much the exception on this campus. But assuming that the student can really do what we'd like him to do, devote his full time to his seminary program, perhaps he could move more rapidly, get into the field, and in that way serve his Savior for a longer period of time. Mm-hmm. Because we're all confronted with the problem of the shortness of time.
Mm-hmm.
But I do believe that this matter of competency is the thing that we need to strive for and to measure. But there's also this aspect to it, that it's not just the minimum competencies that are to be acquired, but we need to show our students how they can continue to grow. And this ties in again with what Dr. Schultz said, the pressure of work where the student is forced to settle for the minimum. He completes the minimum assignments and really does not take advantage of the tremendous resources here, and I'm thinking particularly of the library. He does the readings that he has to do. And that's one of the things that all of us, I'm sure, are struggling with, to try to bring these things together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sure that there's no question in my mind that you do operate with that at this point, with competencies. You have certain tests that you give students, and their competencies in the languages and in the biblical knowledge, and so on. I guess my thrust here was applying that same approach to the skills of ministering that knowledge, and whether there's any way in which that can be done more effectively, that's the question, I think.
Okay, anyone else with it? Andy, please.
As a relative neophyte who's not the machinery, I'm still somewhat unclear of the real relationship between the BHE and the various schools. Seminary. On the one hand, I'm hearing people say that the schools have to fly on their own.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I've experienced already instances where
Well, I suppose that in some ways I would have to say I inherit a situation, and that's the way it is, and you work with that situation. I have a strong feeling that these schools perhaps do have to be given the authorization to go ahead and try to develop programs, because they simply will not be able to function remaining just as preparers for church workers, professional church workers. The schools simply could not exist. We don't need that many at all if that's what they are for. Now, I think the approach has been that there is more, though, to the education than simply the preparation of church workers, but there is a preparation of dedicated Christian lay people in various places as well. Now, when you come to the duplication of programs, which I discussed, here is where I think the Board for Higher Education needs to exercise some careful examination and scrutiny so that you do not allow those programs to proliferate, or if they proliferate, you must evaluate them at intervals, and those which obviously are not successful would have to be eliminated. They would simply have to eliminate them, and I think that's what's going to happen. I think that they will die of their own accord. In the meantime, the Board for Higher Education, when new programs are proposed, always asks the question, what is the impact of it? Does it involve the addition of faculty does it involve the addition of staff? Does it involve the addition of equipment? What is the total impact of that? And in most cases, I would say that in many cases, the schools are operating in a situation which is such that there was a time when they were being flooded with students, and faculty members were added again and again. In the meantime, many of those have not left, and they are able to add these programs without adding additional faculty. And so by bringing in more students, they feel they can bring in more income. I think each one must be looked at individually. The board, as far as I'm concerned, does not and should not just approve any program. There are some that have been rejected, and there are some requests that have come for movement to a four-year program which have not been accepted either. So if you're talking about its relationship to it, I think the board can only exercise its authority as it refuses to grant permission to do something, or if the school decides to do it on its own, refuses to provide the funding for that program. Now, the problem, of course, is that you will have individual schools who go to seek their funds anywhere and everywhere, and that also then destroys the ability of the Synod as a whole to gather its funds and support the programs which it approves. That's why I raised the question in this paper about the possibilities, whether there are any possibilities even, of a, quote, seminary board of education and a university board. Because I think that as long as you have each individual school under its own individual board of control, that is what will happen. I'm not sure that the Synod would buy that. I am not sure that the individual districts and schools would buy it. And you know as well as I do how much pressure is brought by individual schools in the synodical meetings when a favorite program of theirs may be jeopardized. They marshal all their forces, and sometimes the Synod passes some resolutions which are not in agreement with the thinking of the Board for Higher Education, and then but the board is required to implement them. So I don't know if I've talked around your question, Annie. I haven't really answered it, but I do see that the board is going to have to exercise some more control in terms of the evaluation of those programs and the monitoring of them.
Sorting out some of the points that I've emphasized, it seems to me that this topic of competency needs some special attention. This is reinforced by my casual experiences over the past couple of weeks in just bumping into members of different congregations in a few different places, not so far from home base, and couple different pastors speaking about their experiences and so on.
Get home.
Did you get Horace's name? Pastors don't really know what the real purpose of the ministry is. And when we talk about competency, I think we need to find new ways that in true collegiality, in the seminary faculties, we can get back once more to the classical and biblical, I would say, Lutheran insight that the core purpose and function of the ministry is to be a sales worker, a curate of souls. I have had laymen come to me and grouse, what do you teach those young men when they come out from the congregation? They don't know what it means to provide spiritual leadership for our people. You heard that a couple weeks ago. Then I think beyond that, we need though also to help our students. It's not only or simplistically being able to find the core of, say, being a spiritual leader, but we have to, like we heard in this morning's presentation, show our people what it means to lead a Christian life vis-a-vis the challenges of the world. And there, I think, Lutherans in modern complex society are notoriously poor in really emphasizing and developing this insight. But to come to a point that Dick Schultz alluded to here, when our people come from so many different backgrounds and from with so different a set of experiences and equipment academically, different ethnic identities, different economic potential, I wonder whether simply holding to the somewhat, and forgive me for using the term, somewhat formalistic seminary structure may not actually do some of these people an injustice. I think some of the college students that we have had here, who maybe by force of circumstances are compelled to be content with mediocrity, that agonizes me. When I see well-equipped men, 35 or so, with a family, being satisfied if they barely make C's in their courses, never read a book beyond what is absolutely minimal requirement, and then they go out. I wonder whether we don't have to consider, and in the context of what you mentioned, Walt, the global responsibility of our church, and I don't mean only here in the 50 states or in North America. I was just mentioning to Walter that the board for missions wrestles with the problem of trying to keep about a dozen seminaries and partner churches going. And if you want to see starved and anemic seminary programs, I can point them out to you. Latin American seminary and South America, they look good and flourishing. And our church will not really fulfill its mission in this area of preparing pastors and church workers till we see this in the global dimension and till we can find the kind of flexibility that we can meet these people where they are, both geographically, but above all, where they are in their family situation. And maybe we need to develop some extension programs where we can take some of these people that Dick Schultz mentioned and give them a part-time program while they stay in their normal occupation. Mm-hmm. When you uproot them, they have to find new part-time jobs here. I know I've had students come to me working 35 hours a week in a job that was not their main specialty, where they earned probably half of what they did before they gave up their full-time professional job to prepare for the ministry. And these are areas that we really need to sit down and reevaluate and reconsider.
Augie is next.
I guess I have two questions chiefly. First of all, expressing my appreciation for the presentation that you have shared with us, which I can fully understand as being an extremely difficult kind of task. But basically, in terms of the discussion and your presentation, I'm wondering whether you'd want to tackle two questions.
Depends on the questions.
At the present time, if my statistics are correct, we're still dealing with vacancies amounting to about 500.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that the LCA has a surplus of probably 400 clergymen, and maybe a majority of them may be women. But be that as it may, they have difficulty placing their men. The ALCA is getting into that same kind of situation. Question number one, is there a trend which is developing that we may be heading towards an oversupply? And if so, what the implications are if we're not heading in that same direction? Why do we happen to be different than the two other large Lutheran bodies in America? And the second question deals particularly with the supervisory role coupled with continuing education. I think we're all agreed that continuing education, I like your illustration, that even in confirmation instruction, it is impossible to fill the suitcase of knowledge for a young man or woman for the rest of his or her life. We certainly cannot do that here, which implies that perhaps an aggressive continuing education program should be designed. But it appears as though the seminary, after placement, is completely transferring its role of theological training to another set of instruments within the church.
Mm-hmm.
And I think one would almost question at times whether an administrator, an individual involved in pure church administration, such as a district president, for example, or even a circuit councilor, would be the proper individual to provide the kind of supervision in terms of the potential lack of continuing education. Would you comment on these two?
Okay. All right, and with regard to the first one, I think it's possible that we could be moving in that direction of bridging the gap between supply and demand. It depends upon very much upon the implementation of the resolutions which were passed in the last synodical convention. If we move into those mission fields, if we open as many mission stations as were stated as our goal, then of course I don't think that that gap will be closed very quickly. I think if it is, I don't think that's necessarily bad either. I think that might give us the opportunity to really prepare people for specialized kinds of ministries then. You know, I think that we would have the opportunity to really go into some areas there which we cannot now do, cannot enter at the moment. I think that might be a possibility to go beyond, you know, what we are doing. With regard to the second question, you hit upon a question which I have here, and I just raise a question on this. In the field of education, people who are teachers are often required for the maintenance of their certification to enroll in courses within a specified interval of time. Now, can we successfully market continuing education for pastors in the same way? Is that desirable? Is it practical? Now, if you can answer those questions, then you might have an answer to it. But yes, I think that that's the area. There should be encouragement on the part of circuit counselors, district presidents, everyone, to have people become, in effect, quote, recertified, if you want.
I think before we quit, Walt, we ought to have you at least read your all of your questions that you prepared, so that we can take them up in another form in case we don't get at them today. I have the following names, Marty Henschke, Horace, Eric, and myself. Did I miss anyone? Okay, we'll proceed in that order then. Marty would be next.
Thank you for a very stimulating presentation, Walt. I have two questions too in relation to competency-based approaches. You've covered it pretty well that this should not provide a ceiling, obviously, for creativity purposes. One would be the kind of argument that we get into sort of interfacing liberal arts philosophy over against competency, as as if these two are exclusive of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember in a meeting we shared not long ago, a very heated argument taking place between the 10-week crash course in Hebrew or Greek,
mm-hmm.
and this measured against 4 years
mm-hmm.
of the liberal arts kind of exposure,
mm-hmm.
and what happens at the seminary level, that the people who are the
mm-hmm.
result of the crash course come in with better skills than the 4-year people,
mm-hmm.
and as a result, where's our liberal arts philosophy going in terms of assimilation, in terms of acculturation, and all of these other things that we're going to settle for a competency-based approach that reduces the subject matter to a 10-week crash course
mm-hmm.
because it seems to work better in terms of intensification. That's one of my questions, if you would comment on that particular argument. The other question that I have relates to separating function, that is skill, from personality. Obviously, if you're going to set criteria for skills, you're going to have to set criteria for personality. And of course, Scripture speaks very eloquently as to what a shepherd should be in terms of personality.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do you envision setting competency levels for both skills as well as personality, combination of both? I, of course, have a vested interest in this because much of my teaching deals with a skill that definitely involves personality, namely pastoral counseling.
Mm-hmm. In regard to the first question, I have a strong feeling that it's very possible for people who take a quick course, crash course as you call it in these, to develop some of the same skills, and these are very fresh in their minds. The very fine nuances of the language were learned sometime earlier by those who went through a system, and they may have forgotten them because they were not using them, but they are fresh in the minds of those who have just taken it. Now that's one thing. The other thing, though, is that I do believe that a liberal arts approach certainly gives one a total view, which is different than if one simply learns a skill applied to a particular thing. I think there is a total world view that is involved and an understanding of the world that can only be gleaned from gained from that kind of an approach, a liberal arts. That may not be true. And liberal arts, of course, can happen, and learning can happen through experiences which people have too. And so that's the one thing. The other item which you had related to setting of competencies or standards for personality, as I would understand, or personal characteristics. And I think that you can set those things. I think they should be set as ideals. I think they have to probably, we always have to understand that nobody ever reaches those ideals or has reached those ideals in all areas which you might establish. One might compensate for the other, you know. So I think you set them simply as goals. These are what would be the ideal, and you know, that's where you're at, and you determine at what point the person has developed so that he is competent enough, quote, to meet those situations. I believe very strongly, personally, you know, I have arguments with the people on the staff at St. Paul's when I was there. I have a number of men, one in particular, who insisted they could tell you just exactly what this student was going to do because he knew his background, and he knew all of the other things that were there. And I said, if you know exactly what he's going to do, then I think, and that's absolutely true, then I think I better get out of the business and turn it over to you, and because I really do believe the gospel can still change people. And if you're saying that it's all predetermined, that this is the way a person will be and he cannot change, I think you're denying the power of the Spirit and the working through the gospel.
I think it's increasingly going to be a serious matter, and I wonder if we've ever really confronted that. That we have just sort of fallen into the general American program that, in effect, you know, anyone who has a PA is available for entrance.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little fine print beyond that.
Yeah.
And that just means, you know, a radically different type of student that enters in. Now, in particular, I don't do that language business too.
Mm-hmm.
The whole full soon. But, well, I'd just like to hear your thought a little bit as to what the, as to what the board can do. I wonder if this isn't something where the board can't be of great help over and above what the individual institutions, the seminaries, including our situation, can do, because as I read it now, we have, you know, at this point, a rather unhealthy competition. One thing that sticks in our fall, of course, is that Fort Wayne does not require Hebrew, and how can they fail? Which perhaps makes sense, of course, when they were able to quote unquote practice seminary. Now they compete, you know, for the same clientele, and it's not so readily defensible. And as things work out now, in effect, you know, we compete not for excellence, but we compete, you know, for the lowest common denominator, so we don't lose students at all costs. And I suspect that's not only true with language, but of other areas as well. If I may, this feeds into the other area that you may or may not wish to comment on. The one thing that surfaced a lot among us here, as I suppose you know, is the feeling that the VAC is constituted has not, perhaps not been set up to pay as much attention as they should to specifically theological education. Perhaps we need a separate board or a separate chair or something like that. And I'm not sure how structurally it would be the best way to confront that problem. But I think that remains a problem. I think this is just one example of that. At this point, at least, in terms of policing entrance requirements, that perhaps only the church can do it. If the two institutions are going to try to do it, why it's going to, I think, drag us down and not work for the maintenance of standards.
Yeah, I understand the problem you're talking about. We have certainly dealt with, you know, brought it up for discussion, and it's come up for discussion many times. I think there have been some attempts to try to bring the seminaries together to determine what kind of entrance requirements in the area of language there ought to be, what kind of requirements should be there. You may be absolutely right, and of course I suppose the question arises as to whether the Board for Higher Education should direct this is the way it shall be. I guess I'm getting right back to that whole question once more about individual control and individual boards and so on. It's difficult to deal with unless you have an acceptance then of the overall authority of the board to make those pronouncements and those requirements. Or something that I wanted to say. Oh, yes, when you're talking about the matter of admission requirements, I guess I would raise the other questions, and this relates to the whole matter of the system or association of schools as well. I think that the question has to be raised too about admission requirements in other terms besides those knowledge areas. I know that there were times when I did not recommend students from St. Paul's, nor did I at Seward, whom I didn't think were qualified for it. Now, I don't know how much that happens, but I would do it on the basis of what I would see in terms of their attitude, in terms of their total personality. They were not the kind of people who could serve in that way.
I have Eric and myself yet. Eric, please.
Matter of continuing education, I think, is a cry of need in our churches. And I don't think you go very far to see that need. Last week, I had the privilege to talk to a man from the LCA who's involved in that program as one of the men who is the teacher in these regionals. He told us that every LCA church is encouraged to put a certain item in the budget. I think of $600 sticks in my mind, but it's a two-figure, I don't remember for sure. And that every church is urged, I think almost required, to give the pastor 2 weeks off each year to enable him to permit him to take courses of various natures in the area of continuing education. And has been, according to this man, a rather successful phenomenon in the LCA, except in an area of the country where you would expect that. And I just wonder if we as a church do not need very desperately and very carefully to think the whole matter through and do something to because I think the need is very evident.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree with you. I've been meeting with several people, one from the Board for Parish Education, one from the Personnel Office of the Synod, and discussing this issue on the same basis as you described it, in terms of congregations enrolling in the program, providing an annual amount, and a certain amount, of course, to be paid also by the person who is enrolled in the program, because they feel that he does not realize the value of it unless there is also some input on his part monetarily. So it's the kind of program we're looking for, and we're raising questions as to what areas of continuing education should there be. Should these be on regional level? Should they be at the institutions? Should they be in terms of workshops? Do you give equivalent credit for some experience kind of thing? What kind of experiences should we have? Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Utilize the facilities of education institutions in their area, either their own or public institutions. Those facilities that seem to be the most practical and most practical way of doing it.
I think they've set a good pattern for it, and that whole growth in ministry program is an excellent one.
Well, I have two questions, one shorter than the other. Let me take the short one first. In today's mail, there is a
letter. I didn't send you a letter.
No, we had a good day today. In today's mail, there's a letter from Mark Zill of Synod Stewardship Department that, fairly brief letter that he says is just for our information. He wanted me to know that he has recommended that the Synod completely underwrite the cost of running the seminaries, and that the funds needed to implement that proposal be the responsibility of the Department of Stewardship.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't say to whom he had made this proposal, whether it was to the BHE or to the Board of Stewardship or to the Board of Directors, but may I pick your brain on it? How do you feel about that kind of possibility? Would it, for example, lead to the opposite problem from the problem of the independence of institutions that are forced to raise substantial percentages of their own support? The danger is always that they tend to become independent mm-hmm. of the Synod. While it all sounds very good that Synod would provide 100% of the funding of a seminary, just to think negatively for a minute, would that perhaps result in control of synodical theological education by people who are not theologians or pastors, and who look at it primarily from the standpoint of the dollar? At any rate, do you see any openings for alternate ways of financing theological education? Because that's really gotten to be a tail that wags the dog in many cases.
Mm-hmm. I really don't think of any others that I can envision than the church itself doing it. And I think that the church does have that responsibility. When you say the control of the education, I would hope that would be handled through the Synodical Board for Higher Education, which is usually not too unreasonable. But I think that the Synod is responsible for it eventually. And I grant you that there's no question about it that if the church provides the funds, they would also be in a position to control what is taught there. But I would hope for some sanity there.
Yeah, I would too. I like the letter because I think it's a step in the right direction. That the support level has been steadily dwindling, and it's mm-hmm. down to about 30% for this coming year. I think we would all agree it ought to be higher than that.
Yes.
Let me ask another more involved question. I'm not sure whether it's altogether rhetorical, whether you'd like to answer it. Your appeal to competency-based education, I think, is a very good one. But it raises a whole raft of questions. For example, competency in what?
Mm-hmm.
And Horace, I think, began to speak to that point with reference to Hebrew. I was thinking along the same lines, and thinking along lines of a phone call I had from Will Hyatt back in July wanting to know what I thought the faculty here would think about a variety of tracks for the pre-ministerial program at Concordia College in St. Paul, Minnesota. An alternate track that he was talking about was, for example, an education major. And we've been running into, I think Dean Hempelman could tell us more about this, but we quite frequently run into students in college who have chosen Seward, River Forest, St. Paul, mm-hmm. Minnesota, because they've been told by their pastor or someone else that the pastor spends 60% of his time in education. Why don't you go get a good major in education? Because you never learn anything about that at SEM, except a little dab here and there. And of course, there have been others who have been promoting their own baccalaureate fields.
Mm-hmm.
There are some fields that have sort of come into their own since the classical model of seminary education in the Missouri Synod was developed. Fields like sociology and psychology, mm-hmm. urban studies, and so on. Kind of a rhetorical question, but competency in what?
Mm-hmm.
And today we have, I think the fact is that the seminaries are determining the competency in what. We have Fort Wayne with a model that is fairly close to ours, but not entirely, and the Hebrew is the great difference. You have the colloquy program, which really is, with all due respect to the men who run it and try to give it some direction, is a bit of an unding. You have a whole variety of competencies in it, and some attempt has been made in the last years to bring about regularization of the programs, but there's a great variety there. And again, who is determining the competencies, the level of competencies and preparation? So in a sense, a rhetorical question, but competency in what? And the second question related to it is, who decides competency? One of the side remarks I'd make in that regard is the growing interest that I find personally in having the Missouri Synod buy into the ATS Readiness for Ministry instrument or mm-hmm. something like it.
Yeah.
Seems to me to be the best thing we have at this point, but some instrument that would begin to give us feedback, not only while our students are in seminary, but perhaps 3 years, 5 years, 10 years after they're out, as to whether or not we're really preparing them for what we're doing. Your brother Will and I had a long talk about this at Denver, and Will and I had a meal with Dave Schuler and heard him out on the readiness for ministry thing. I'm wondering how you feel about measurements for mm-hmm. competency and whether a faculty or faculties are able to do that by themselves. I would just a little footnote before you respond, and then I'll shut up. This question of whether our students who are admitted today are as competent as their predecessors.
Mm-hmm.
I think it might be interesting to gather hard data on that, mm-hmm. if it's at all possible. I'm not at all sure that in terms of average statistics that today's students are any lower than they were surely not in my class.
No, I don't think so. Yeah.
I don't know if you'd care to comment on the competency.
Well, I think you've hit on what I feel might be done, and that is utilization of some instruments that might already be available, or the development of your own instruments, and gathering data from pastors out in the field, from supervisors, from district presidents, circuit counselors, from your graduates themselves after 3 years of service out there, and ask them what areas they felt they were best prepared in, which areas they felt incompetent in, which areas they were unprepared for, or where they had the knowledge but were not able to integrate it. I think that's what must be done. And then it's only after that's done that you could do that.
And you'd feel the BHE would be willing to work with the two SEMs in the Council of Presidents in developing some sort of measurement.
Very definitely. We'd be very interested in doing that. And I would say, and I think it relates to the question which Horace had too, question in areas of languages, all of that.
Okay. Our time has really expired, but if we could have one quick comment, and then I would like to ask Walt whether you'd read the questions, just to kind of leave us with some areas for further exploration, and then I think we'll take our 15-minute coffee break. Bob, real quickly, please.
Are you speaking about competency for entrance or graduation or both?
I would be speaking of both. Yes.
Could we ask, Walt has prepared, I can see, some five or six questions that I think he regards as rather important. Maybe you'd... Yeah.
We've probably hit on most of them, but I state them in this way. All right. I'll even leave you some copies, just since I brought a few extra. But I'll read them here at this point. First one was, assuming the roles of prophet, parenthesis knowledge, servant, parenthesis attitude, and priest, parenthesis skills, assuming the roles of prophet, servant, and priest, for which role have we been most successful in preparing potential pastors? And we would have had time, I probably would have given you a sheet of paper and say, rating it 1 to 5, in which area you think, on the basis of 1 to 5, how well do you think we've done in preparing as the prophet, area of knowledge, area of attitude, area of skill? Okay, number two, what procedures are used by you or your department or the seminary in determining the competencies necessary for successful pastoring in the 80s? I guess this would involve some relationship to the people who are out there practicing it and what they see. Is it possible to state the basis for certification in terms of competencies? Can competencies be stated apart from courses required, and can credit be given for competencies possessed or acquired without course involvement? And then I had already mentioned that teachers are often required for maintenance of certification to enroll in courses for a specified within a specified interval. Can we successfully market continuing education for pastors in the same way? So, and then the sixth one, based on the follow-up studies which you have carried out, what do the results indicate with regard to the sufficiency and effectiveness of preparation of potential pastors? And that would be relating to your question earlier reviewing the views of your graduates maybe 2, 3, 4 years ago. And then finally, how can you validate admission in terms of the product you try to produce? You say, you know, is it possible, you know, if a person is way, way down here or has this kind of a personality or something else which would just almost make him inadequate for the ministry, ever, in your opinion. You know, what are your admissions, and how do you validate those admissions?
Walt, I know I speak for all of us in thanking you for your thoughtful and careful presentation, the many good questions you've raised, and I think as much as anything, the spirit of goodwill and cooperation, the sense that we are partners on the same team that you have brought to the discussion this afternoon. And I think I speak for all of us in assuring you of this faculty's complete support and our prayers, and any work that you need from us, please feel free to call on us at any time. So thank you very, very much.